Hello, everybody. It's 10 a.m., so we're going to kick this off. I'm Stephanie Booth, and I'll be moderating this panel, Lost in Translation, where we hope to give you some insight on localizing. Oh, so I was just going to tell you. Would you please be so kind as to, A, put your mobile phones on silent or something that will not disturb the audience, and B, if you've got your laptop open, also remove the sound from your laptop, because that can be quite loud too. I'm actually going to do it on mine. There. To start, I'd like to ask the panelists to very briefly introduce themselves. So I'm going to ask you to do this in the following way. And I apologize for the coughing, I'm coming down with a cold. I'm going to ask you to, first of all, think up three tags to describe yourself, three keywords to describe yourself as a person outside of the web. Okay, so I'm telling you this first so that you can think about it for a few seconds. Because if I don't give you time to think about it, you're, you know, going to be tempted to repeat what your neighbor said or something. Then I'd like just a few words about your linguistic cultural background. You know, where are you in the language department? As this is all about languages, I think it's interesting to know what kind of profiles we've got on this panel. And also a few words on your involvement in localization, internationalization, translation efforts, etc. But without getting into the story, okay, just give us a list of, you know, stuff you've been involved in or what you're going to, basically what experience you've got in that area. Right. So who wants to start? So Stephanie's going to start. We're going to start with Stephanie and come over here to Kevin at the end.
Is it because I'm the obligatory lady on this panel? I got to start first, is it? Okay, three words. Polyglot. Web Smith. I'm not sure that's two words or one. Is that? I do web stuff. So I can't think of a third word. But in terms of a linguistic background, so I've had people coming up to me during the last couple of days saying, well, "What? Where are you from? What's this accent you've got?" I was born in Borneo. I grew up in Australia. I spent 10 years in Australia, and now I'm living in French Canada. So I speak four Chinese dialects or languages, depending on your opinion on what's a dialect and what's a language. English, which is what I'm speaking now. I understand Malay very well. I get really rusty, you know, but I speak French where I live. Is that comprehensive?
That's good enough. Okay. Thank you very
much. Oh, my involvement in localization. I work for a web agency in Montreal, and when you are working in Canada, most of the sites you produce for corporates are by default in French and English. It's very rare that you end up doing stuff in one language only. So that's my professional background. The other thing I've been involved in for the last 2 years is the Web Standards Project International Liaison Group. I co-lead that with Glenda Sims, and basically we coordinate a bunch of web standards advocates all around the world and discuss what's the best way to teach web standards locally.
Thank you. Kelly?
I'm Kelly Thompson, Executive VP at iStock Photo. Three words: tall, geeky, and obsessed. Languages, I'm really embarrassed to say that I speak French very poorly, and I'm also from Canada, which is a bit of an issue sometimes. My involvement in localization and translation, I helped oversee the move for iStock in the past year and a half to localize in seven different languages.
I'm Brian McConnell. I guess the three tags I'd use to describe myself. I'm an author, inventor, and prankster. My background in linguistics is pretty limited as well. I've been fascinated by the problem of communicating across language barriers since I was a child. But personally, I have a difficult time picking up foreign languages. I'm literate in Spanish. I can read pretty well, but speaking to people is pretty hopeless. And so I got into this in a way because I was interested in solving my own problem, which is I'm very interested in reading material from abroad. I travel extensively, but I just know I'm not going to pick up other languages anytime soon, at least, you know, to become fluent. So what I do now is I work on an open source project that makes a variety of localization and collaborative translation tools that make it easier to pull things across a language barrier, whether it's a web application or web content.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Marks. My three words would be bibliophile, English, eccentric. I work for Google. I primarily work on OpenSocial, which is the standard for building web applications you can take into other sites that have members, such as social networks. As part of that, there's work there to abstract out fields and things so they can be translated once by the container and not by each individual application. Previously, I've managed a software project that involved being localized into 12 languages, and it's included a chat bot that would try and converse with you in your language and have Socratic dialogues with you. So that was my hardest localization problem. And at Google, there's a strong push for localization. I'm actually replacing my colleague who was unwell. So I'm not an expert on Google localization, but it does permeate everything we do. Everything we do has to be localized to 40 languages.
Thank you. I just realized that I would have to do this too. So my three tags would be cat, judo, and people. I've actually never been involved per se in a localization project large scale, aside from contributing to open source efforts. I'm a French-English bilingual. I was born in England, raised in Switzerland, so I've always lived with two languages. And this has brought me early on to being really interested in how languages work. And, of course, as I became interested in the web, I found myself with one foot in the French-speaking internet and one foot in the English-speaking internet. And that raised all sorts of questions and problems. So there you are for me. Now, hopefully you now know a little bit more about our panelists. Just one thing, because I have a lot of trouble hearing them, but I know the sound is not directed to us. So just if there is trouble understanding any of the panelists, please, you know, stand up, wave your hands and say so. Does anybody want to speak up now? Good. Okay, so I guess it's not that bad. So localization or internationalization, these two terms are used, sometimes in an interchangeable manner, but sometimes as two different things. So I'd like to ask the panelists first, from maybe a terminology point of view, what words do you use? Do you use localization? Do you use internationalization? What do you mean by both, by either of these terms? So, does anybody want to pick up this question? Brian?
Yeah, I'll start off on that, I guess. I think the most important distinction to make between the term localization and internationalization or translation is that typically when you talk about localization, you're talking about taking something like a desktop application or a web application and redoing the user interface so it makes sense to somebody that speaks another language. So you're generally not talking as much about live content when you talk about localization. If you are talking about translation, then of course you're typically talking about translating a website itself. So it's kind of a different problem. Often you use different workflow to deal with those two things. So you might have an entirely different group of people doing the localization part of a project, and then other people that do translation on an ongoing basis. So that's how I usually distinguish the two.
Okay, so if I summarize what you've said, make sure I got it correctly. Localization is about the interface, and translation is about the content. Would that be correct?
Yeah, and also branding, you know, sometimes would be part of localization as well. You might have different, you know, different personality for the site in some cases. But yeah, typically you're talking about application versus content.
Okay. Does anybody want to add something? Maybe as far as localization and internationalization are concerned,
right,
Kevin?
So I was going to say that internationalization is the process of making sure your application can be translated, which means abstracting out stuff so that strings aren't hard-coded into the code but are looked up in a database, and that you're ready for different input methods so you can deal with bidirectional text and things like that. So that the initial process of getting ready for localization is internationalization, making sure your app is not making assumptions about what language you're writing it in.
Okay. Does anybody have another interpretation of what internationalization and localization are?
I just have something really small to add. I think we need to put it on the table that localization is a little more than just translation. So it is more than just translating what the words mean. It's usually translating the concept behind something, or like say date formats is a usual one, like calendar formats.
Okay, thank you. I actually, when I was preparing this panel, I looked up internationalization and localization on Wikipedia. So Wikipedia is not necessarily the final answer to something, but it's a very interesting starting point. And I'm going to try to show you these pages. Internationalization led me to this page, internationalization and localization, which is basically translating, in the wide sense, an application or an interface for use in another country, culture, or linguistic group. And what was more interesting for me is that language localization, they seem to be saying that this is about different versions of a same language. So, you know, that there's British English, there's American English, and many other languages have this kind of variation. So I thought it was pretty interesting to see that definitely localization and internationalization and even translation aren't terms which we can use without a question, assuming that the person opposite us is going to understand exactly what we mean. So in this panel, we used internationalization in the title. And I think that what we want to indicate with this is that we're not just going to talk about language issues, but also the cultural issues. So I think that's important. One thing I didn't mention is that we are, well, maybe not directly I, because I'm a bit preoccupied by moderating this, but we as a panel are keeping an eye on the Meebo chat. So if you want to log on to meebo.com/sxsw, there is a chat there where you can hopefully find some of the panelists, if they manage to get on there too, and ask questions. And we're also going to try to keep an eye on Twitter. So if you know our usernames, you can try to direct questions to us by Twitter. I'm not sure if this will work, but we're going to try. Now, let's get to the meat of this panel. I think all the panelists here have got localization or internationalization stories to tell us. Things that went well, things that went badly. They all mentioned projects in which they've been involved. So I'd like to ask you to talk a bit more in detail about the experiences that you've had with internationalization. And we don't have to start with Stephanie. If somebody else wants to pick up the microphone first, you're free.
So I can give you some horror stories about how our first efforts at translation went on iStock. The first round, we used our community quite a bit to help us with the translations. It worked okay, but it was difficult to manage, and there was just such a huge volume that we decided we had to take it to kind of a professional level to have done. We went to a large firm in Hong Kong that specialized in doing exactly what we were looking for, and they also handled all seven of the languages. What came back was some of the languages were done very well, and some of the languages were done incredibly poorly, including French, as some of the panelists here will attest to. They were going through our site and still kind of cringing on many different pages. We even had some truly unfortunate mistakes as well. For instance, in Russian, we actually have someone in marketing who is Russian and the first language. She happened to be away on maternity leave while the site was being translated. But when she got back, the first time she logged in, I could watch her face turn purple. And she got quite embarrassed, and I asked her what was wrong. And she said that the translation for enter here or log in had actually been translated kind of as the sexual put it in here kind of translation. So, I mean, there's things like that you definitely have to be very, very careful about.
Thank you.
And I would just add, probably the first place to start is with your name or your brand. I haven't been directly involved in managing localization projects for companies. I just, you know, build tools for people. But I'm always surprised at companies, big companies and also startups that will launch a product without really thinking about how their name translates. A funny example, I live part-time in Buenos Aires, and on the subway there, I see signs on every train. They have a little icon of a man just falling out the door and almost getting run over by a train. It says, Evite Accidentes. Evite is an invite service, and in Spanish, it means avoid with an exclamation point. So they apparently didn't catch that. And I mean, I'm not singling them out. I can think of a dozen other companies that have done that. Chevrolet is probably the most famous example with the Chevy Nova no-go. And so that's a good place to start before you even get into the translation part.
Thank you. Steph or Kevin?
Well, following up on the brand names one, actually Commodore is the best there, because they came up with a computer called the PET, which means fart in French. And then they followed that up with a computer called the VIC, which is very rude in German.
So do you have any internationalization stories you'd like to share with us, Kevin?
I don't have... The trickiest one I had was this project with the chatbots, where... this was we took the book Sophie's World, which is a philosophical book journey, and part of that there's all these Socratic dialogues. So we said, oh, we'll build that as a chatbot, and then we managed to sell the rights to 12 different countries, and we had the problem of translating a chatbot that was looking for keywords in English into Korean and Japanese and Norwegian and so on.
So can you just explain what exactly is a chatbot?
So. You type a phrase in, and the characters in the book respond to you. So it's like being in a chat room, except the other parties aren't human. And so what we had two different characters. We had Sophie and the professor who's teaching her, and they're both trying to talk to you. And they're basically looking for keywords in what you're saying to try and lead you through a dialogue. And this was a long time ago, at least 10 years ago. So the state of chatbots was not what it was. And we had enormous trouble with this, because what we ran into was that you use different modes of address in some languages depending on who you're talking to. So if you're talking to Sophie, who's a 14-year-old girl, you'd use one mode. If you're talking to the professor, you'd use the formal mode of writing to him. And so the problem of the chatbot was we had to expand all the... in English, it was a simple set of keywords. We're looking for things to try and feed into the next phrase. And for languages that were more formal, like Japanese... we had to expand that many different ways, because how people would respond to it were very different depending on whether they were thinking they were being formal or whether they were thinking they were being informal. So there was sort of, you often find from English that there is this sort of expansion of different possibilities, because English is very terse and very ambiguous in this way.
Yeah. one little story that this reminds me of is Flickr was recently localized, the photo sharing site. And one of my friends who's a German speaker said, "Gah, this totally freaks me out, because now Flickr is being formal with me, because before in English it was you. And you know, in German there is Sie and Du, okay, informal and formal. And they'd chosen the formal address, which totally didn't fit with his experience of what the site had been for him. Stephanie?
I'm not sure I have more else to add, but it's actually the same in French too. So, yeah. Do you want to demo that bot yet, or shall we? I think it's a good timing for that now.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that. There's a lot of echo.
Oh, from here. I was wondering whether we should just show that bot that Kevin was talking about. The bot.
Chatbot. So. Okay. So, as I was talking about chat, this is something. Google launched just before Christmas, which is there are translating chatbots. So if I say, it will then translate, the chatbots will hopefully translate that into French for you. No, so you decide not to do it. So Stephanie wrote, you know, wake up or else, to the bot, which got translated back to English here. The bots try and suppress ones that are in the language, in the wrong language, but they sometimes get confused. We've got English to French and French to English. And the French one looks like it's just like trying to correct your... it's paraphrased the French back into another kind of French, which is interesting.
So this is clearly not website localization. Okay, but I think that experiments like this one or tools that play around with language are actually really important because they give us indications on what things to pay attention to when you're translating a website into another language and when you want to make it compatible with another culture. So I'd like to quiz the audience a little bit, maybe wake you up. By doing a little survey, got the questions there. So I'll just ask you to raise your hand. Who here feels at home in more than one language? Panelists can also contribute. Okay. Whose best language or first language here is not English? Okay. Now, this is interesting. Okay, we're in the US. If we were in Europe, and this was an equivalent conference in Europe, even an English-speaking conference, the ratios would be completely different, okay? Who lives in a country where the official language is not English? Wow. Okay. Again, this in Europe would be a completely different ratio. I asked this kind of questions at the conference reboot in Copenhagen, and it was very, very different. Now, do we have any translators in the room? Hello. Hello. Hello.
Surprisingly low okay. ratio. Yeah.
You're do a
special
we have...
breed.
Sorry?
I was just saying translators are a special breed.
I hope that everybody here is aware that being bilingual does not make you a translator. It's not because you're comfortable speaking two languages or even writing in them that you master the art of translation. And maybe some of the disaster stories that we've got here do any of the panelists have stories to tell about that? Kelly, maybe? Or?
Yeah. You can probably talk to it almost better than I can. But for us, oddly, being a Canadian company, French turned out to be, for some reason, one of the most difficult languages for us to get right. The first time it was translated, it was actually done in Quebec. And we had lots of complaints from France that it sounded very Quebecois. And they were actually, out of all the languages we did, when we got that one wrong, they seemed to be the most insulted by it. So the next version of the translation was done in France, or it was done by French speakers from France, but the translation was incredibly poor, as we quickly found out again. You can maybe...
Yeah, maybe I'll just... I'll continue the survey. I've not finished with it. But as we've gone off on this, can you switch to me, please? So here's the current version of the ISOC photo site in French, Of course, I went to look at it. So Kelly tells me that it is being reworked. Okay, so this is they're aware that there's a problem here. But when you see things like appliquer maintenant, I don't know if there are any people amongst you who know French. Of course, literally, it means apply now, but it is apply like apply a cream on your body. It's that kind of application. Or a bit lower down, here you have a redundancy, right, with page twice. So maybe the training page is a string somewhere, and there's, I don't know, something weird here happened in the translation. Okay, so lots of localized and internationalized websites are like that. And if this is what you're being served in your language, it feels a bit... I guess that it can feel a bit like you're treated like a second zone customer if you're getting that. Brian, you want to say something?
One comment I'd have to add, just to give some background on what I do. The project I work on it's a collaborative translation project. It's the best way to describe it briefly is like Wikipedia for translation. So it's an open system that a lot of people can contribute to. And one of the things we found is that we generally get the best contributions when the translators or amateur translators are working on content that they're already familiar with. So they're translating a friend's blog, they're translating an online magazine that they read anyway. So they're familiar with the jargon and just the background of the material that they're reading. And I think one of the reasons why a lot of localization efforts are low quality is because the translators, particularly professional translators, tend not to be computer people. They tend to be language people and just generally are not all that up to speed on computer jargon and terminology that a lot of people in this room would take for granted. So it's easy for them to get, the apply now example is kind of a classic example of where a professional translator will get confused when they're translating a web interface. You gave that same person a document that was just normal English or normal Spanish, they'd have a much easier time with it. So it's important to match the language resources of the translators up with material that they're familiar with.
Yeah, so this kind of matches something I was thinking, that you need the people doing the translation to be involved to some extent in what they're translating. If they're completely outside, then it makes the job more difficult and the resulting translation is not going to be as nice.
Yes, and obviously, as you'll learn quickly, context is everything. If they can't see it in context, it will be wrong.
One of the whole thing when we do as an agency and a design process, so I mean, if you think of a usual classic design process, you start with the wireframes and you do the design, and then you eventually produce the site. Quite often, the people who are actually approving the design and the wireframes, even though the idea is that the site is being internationalized, you actually have to do it in a language they understand. And quite often, they will not be willing to pay for adjusting the design to work in, say, something like German, which is, as we know, if you have done sites in German, you kind of really, is that where fluid layouts are your friends, seeing as German words are very long. We have already the problem in English and French, where French phrases are typically longer than English phrases. But most of the scenarios we find, the designs have to be done in English for the client to understand the context of the site. If you can, I would suggest actually making your client aware that they also have to see things in French, or if that they understand that there has to be budget for the French or other languages you're catering for. And actually make sure that budget is allocated at different stages in your wireframes, in your design. So during the wireframing stage, for example, it is probably very beneficial to have a translator or someone who knows other languages on board at the very beginning so that they can point out to you the potential words that will be difficult later in design and development.
Yeah, so even from a purely interface perspective, localization is not just replacing the words in one language with the words in another language.
Exactly.
Anybody want to add something on that topic?
I mean, there's one kind of backing up a little bit too. In different fields, especially you know, for iStock, there's certain concepts that we see all the time, you know, royalty-free stock photography. That concept may not necessarily exist in every language, and it makes it incredibly difficult. For instance, Russian was one of the languages where there almost are no words to really describe what that is. So, you know, we had to take a lot of time to try to figure it out, come up with something, you know, that worked, and then use it consistently across the site.
Okay, so I'm going to ask the panelists in a second to show us more stuff, but I'd like to finish a little survey before that. So we've got three or four translators in the room. Do we have anybody in the room who is directly involved in a localization or translation or internationalization effort right now? Okay. Right. Who among you are technical people, like back-end coding engineers? Okay. Are there any linguists in the room?
Define linguists.
People who have studied language in depth. So I would definitely consider that translators are linguists, but you don't have to be a translator to be a linguist. Okay, a few little hands, right? And are there any? This might seem like moving off the topic, but are there any sociologists, ethnologists, anthropologists in the room? A couple. Okay. So human sciences people. Yeah. What I'm trying to get to is that, and I hope that I'm not teaching you anything, internationalization is not just a technical issue. I think it's a hairy technical issue. I'm a bit of a dabbler in everything. So I do a bit of PHP, but that's just about where my coding skills stop. But even with that, I'm aware that from a technical point of view, getting something produced in many languages is a headache. And I'm also a social science person. And I'm really acutely aware that translation has a cultural streak to it. One thing that I'd like to see, I'd like to know more about this worldwide lexicon project that Brian is working on. I actually hadn't heard about it before this panel, and some of the stuff that he showed me I really like. So could we maybe switch the screen to his computer and tell us a bit more about it? Number two.
Thank you. So the Worldwide Lexicon project is an open source project. And what we've been doing over the past few years now is developing collaborative translation and localization tools that make it a lot easier for people to publish in multiple languages and also to develop web applications that are multilingual. So I'm just going to do a couple of real quick demos here. What I'd like to show you first is what we call SLS. It's called Simple Localization System. And it's really simple. It's just a PHP library. If you code in PHP, you can implement this very quickly. I'm on our homepage right now. I'm going to switch to Spanish. And you'll see it will re-render the whole screen in Spanish. So now our whole UI is in Spanish. All the supporting documents in the site are in Spanish. But the cool thing is I can just click on this little pencil icon here. And now anything that's translatable in the user interface is highlighted in yellow. So somebody who's translating the UI, whether they're a volunteer or somebody on your staff or, you know, working for a service bureau, they can just come in and see, okay, this thing hasn't been translated yet. So you can click, pops up a little dialog box. You can type in your translation and save it. It's a very simple little tool, but what it does is it enables people that are working on your site to see what they're doing in context. So they're not typically the way sites are localized is you'll email a text file to somebody and they just see a list of strings that need to be translated, and so they can very easily get confused about what that string means or where it's going to show up in the interface, and this gets around that problem. The other thing that's kind of nice about it is that people translating a site will just automatically start focusing on the most visible parts of your application, you know. So front page, top fold, you know, gets the most attention. So if they don't get around to translating, you know, page 10 of your documentation, chances are they're the only person that's read it anyway. So, it, you know, if the resources are constrained, you know, people will tend to naturally focus on the most important elements of the interface. So that's one of the tools that we do. The other thing we work on is we have a number of multilingual blogging and publishing tools that can be integrated into a variety of content management systems. So just very quickly, this is an example of our WordPress plugin. And the way this works is you'll see under each headline, there's a list of languages that's context sensitive, depends on what languages you have set on your computer, where you're visiting from. And then you'll see previews of any translations that users have posted. The whole idea with this system is to kind of leverage your own audience. So if you have a large enough audience reading your site on a regular basis, just from statistically speaking, you're going to have bilingual people out there, and some of whom are going to be happy to contribute translations for free or, you know, for trade or, you know, or you can pay them directly if you want to. And so I'll just click on the Spanish translation here, and it reloads the translation, and now that page is in Spanish. And then if you see something you don't like or you want to add to, click on Edit, and it pops up a little editor. You can go in, edit the translation, look at the revision history, and you know, so it's basically a wiki approach to translating web content. So I don't want to go, you know, on this any further, but the point is we have a variety of tools like this that are open source that people can use in a variety of different ways. I'd be happy to talk offline if anybody's interested.
Thank you. So we're talking based we're starting from an assumption here, which is that internationalization is something which is important, okay? But I'd like to rethink that assumption a bit. So we're playing devil's advocate a little bit, but not completely. So, of course, everybody does not speak English. If you want your application, website, or whatever to work in Europe, you'd better provide localized versions, because the man on the street does not speak English, at least not when it comes to using a website they're unfamiliar with or a tool that they don't know how to work. But do we have any examples or arguments which would show that localization or internationalization isn't always that important? I know that we've got a few on the panel because I know you guys.
So I can talk to that a bit.
Go on.
Something we found with the open social work, where we're trying to unify the different approaches to social networking, is that every social network will tell you the story of how these users appear they didn't know about. The classic example is Orkut, the Google social network site, which...
Can you just switch to me, to my screen?
So Orkut was this site that was set up in 2004. And it initially got a geeky... American user base. All the people at eTech signed up for it and did the usual things you do with social network sites and pictures of your friends. But it took off in Brazil, in South America. Somehow, a bunch of people in Brazil decided it was interesting and sent it to their friends, and they recruited more friends and so on. Until gradually, there were more Brazilian users than there were American users. This site hadn't been localized at all. It has a fairly simple, you know, iconic view, but the text was in English, and then it just continued to take off over there, to the point where now 60% or more of people who are online in Brazil have Orkut accounts. Orkut in Brazil is very much part of the web experience, to the extent that it's like email there. People will assume you'll have the account and they'll send you messages through it because that's the best way of communicating. And every social networking site that I've spoken to has a story like this. They'll say, yes, we suddenly got all these users in Singapore. We couldn't quite work out where they'd come from and why they were using our site. And it was kind of confusing for our users who weren't from Singapore, because they'd go to the site and everything would be about the bars in Singapore or places to travel. What happens is that these sites don't choose their users. And this will be true of your sites too, I think. The users choose the sites. But the effect is more amplified if you're building a social component where people can refer things to their friends, because then you grow through homophily, through people who are like each other associating on your side. So they will introduce their friends, they'll introduce more friends, and that can change the feel of the cultural feel of your site without you doing any work at all. So Awkward got to the point where it was so heavily Brazilian influenced that the American users were getting nervous about this. Why is everyone talking Portuguese to me? What's going on here? If you look at Awkward now, we did localize. It's localized to lots of languages now, and it's taken off in many other countries, including India and Estonia and Uruguay, and with large communities there. But what you can set up in Orkut now is you say which languages you speak, and then it will only show you connections from people who speak a common language with you. That was one of the things that they did, which was mostly a reaction to the Americans' surprise at this. One of the things that Stephanie says is that everyone is imperfectly multilingual. We all study another language in school. The US, which is allegedly monoglot, is nothing like it. If you actually look closely, what you find is that it's a country of immigrants. There are many people here who speak one language at home and another language at work. So the assumption that your interface should always be in one language and one language only can be a false one. It can be very useful to have parallel language work showing up as well. Can you show the translated search? So can you switch to 3?
Just to note, I'm looking at my Orkut page there on the Beamer for the first time in a year and a half, probably. So it's not necessarily up to date.
So you may not have seen this little link on Google that says language tools, but if you go in, I can say I want to search for pages in another language. So say I want to find French pages on automatic translation software. So that's translated the Logiciel de Traduction Automatique, pardon my appalling accent. So it searched the French, I'll make it a bit bigger so you can see it. On this side over here, you can see here's the original French that it searched for that phrase in, and then it's translating that back into English over here. So here's an example where presenting both languages side by side is actually more useful than trying to present one language. Because I read some French, I did French in school, and I can get by in it. So I can look at these, and I can either go and read the original French, or I can read the translated version over here. Because this link is going through to translate.google.com. If I click through that, this is a competitor of yours. So this has been translated from the French. If I roll over this paragraph, it shows me the original French it's translated from. The most advanced software cannot replace professional translators, which has come from. If I don't like that, I can suggest a better translation if I found a more idiomatic result, and Google will feed that back in.
So that's interesting, because here we've got an example of mixed language content on one web page, and I think for sites which have, or communities which have multilingual audiences which might speak more than one language, It's an interesting step to consider. I think it's not usually done. Most sites really view an internationalization effort as moving over to non-English languages, but still one language at a time. So I think that it looks like there are doors to open in that direction. So I'm going to soon open the questions to the public in like 1 minute. I'll let Kelly talk first, but I'll give you instructions first so you can think up your questions. Please try to keep your questions concise. It makes it easier for us to actually answer them. If you just want to share something or an experience, that is okay too. You don't have to disguise it as a question. Just also try to keep it concise so that other people get a chance to talk too. And there are there's one microphone there. I don't see if there's a second one. So if you want to go and ask a question, stand up to the microphone, go in queue, first comes first served. Kelly.
I actually just wanted to ask a quick question of the audience, or a couple of quick questions. After seeing the Worldwide Lexicon demo, is there anyone who is now allowing their community to translate their site for them? Is anyone doing it? And how many of you would feel comfortable doing it? Okay, I just was curious.
Okay, so if there are any questions for from the audience, it's time to make yourself known. Yes? You need to come to the microphone, or I'm never going to understand what you're saying. I'm sorry. So be nice and let people get up. We'll let you ask the first question.
My question, we talk a lot about copy and things like that. Are there any advances being made in rich media? So either Flash or Flash video, or video applications on the web, things like that.
There's one particularly interesting tool that I've seen called .sub. It's a subtitling tool that is a community subtitling and translation. And I've seen some videos there that have been translated to probably 60 or 70 languages. It's pretty neat.
Next question.
Related to what you just talked about allowing people to translate the content, can you screen in that case the content, like you screen comments on a blog, trackbacks, or is there a way that you can let people do it but make sure that there's no spamming and stuff? Or has it got to be completely open? Do you have any control over that?
Well, we're pretty agnostic about that. It depends on what the publisher wants to do. Some publishers prefer a completely open system, and they just assume their readers will understand, the translations are, you pay what you get what you pay for. Other publishers want to have professional translators in the background to basically screen the translations or score the translators, so they're in the background doing some sort of QA type of role, and that's something we've been spending a lot of time on. It just really depends on the publisher and how much control they want, and also how much they want to pay. Because if you just use volunteers, it's completely free. But of course, you don't have any control in that situation.
No, I personally notice that I have an audience from my blog in Asia, whatever. I see that people read it from Arabic countries, whatever, which I don't know. But I even found a tool that translates. I used Babelfish at one point, but I could read that in French it was all mangled, for example, so I saw no interest in using that tool. Is there a good tool as well to translate, to do automatic translation? Now that's pretty accurate? I mean, besides Google?
I would say look at the Google one. The way that works is statistically by looking at a corpus of parallel language documents, so it can build up statistical translations of phrases, not just of individual words. It also looks at statistical models of phrases in both languages with pure text in those languages, which means it ends up being quite good at translating long structured sentences fairly well. It's not perfect. And one of the reasons that we have that, where's it gone? Have that thing suggest us a better version here, is to gather more statistics so that we can have more stuff to integrate over. We think it's more usable than the classical models that people have built, because they were built trying to build a clever algorithm over a small data set. So we've built a not quite so clever algorithm over a very large data set, basically the web, to try and bring better statistical models to that. When you've only got a small data set, your statistical model will model the popular stuff well, but the rare stuff will not be modeled very well at all. With this, we think it's getting better, but we know it's not perfect. Otherwise, we'd be using it a lot more. But we think it's at the point that you can use it, and you can always go back to read the source text in this way, which makes it easier to make sense for you. But yeah,
thank you.
Very interesting feedback on it. Have a look at it and let me know what you think.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
In English, on an interface, you may have a button which says simply fave, four-letter word. If that was, for example, on a Spanish site, you might have to have an entire sentence saying make this thing a favorite. Which is a whole sentence on a button instead of four letters. So does the panel have any sort of tips or techniques for dealing with that kind of thing, specifically for interface elements?
What, one
wait, Steph, did you want to take that?
That's OK. Okay, you can go first, and I'll add to it.
You can talk after Brian.
Okay. Yeah, one approach that works pretty well is to use icon-based buttons with a mouse over. So if you can come up with a good icon representation for that function, and then just design it so when you mouse over it, you get a long-form explanation of what it is. That can really help a lot with formatting considerations like that. The trick is, a lot of times, there's not a good icon to use, of course. But
right. Want to add something, Steph?
Yeah, one of the things that we've been doing is actually make things that look like buttons when they're supposed to be buttons, but they're actually text. So you can put that through your internationalization engine and actually have translated buttons straight away. But the design issue is usually when the placement of the buttons, because obviously if it's a longer one, you have a problem with space. What I've started doing is just simply using language contextual style sheets. So, for example, if I'm designing a site in French, I actually have a French style sheet that handles slightly different cases for how things have to be positioned differently based on, you know, the button's too long or the instruction is too long or the paragraph needs more margin, something like that. So that's one way I do it.
Yeah.
Kevin?
So I back both those approaches. There's a caveat with using images for buttons is that you need to make sure that the image communicates the same thing in the cultures you're addressing. And that can play into the each language is not a country issue as well, where you'll find you have different cultural associations between South America and Spain, say. The other point is, if you look at the Google style, we're criticized for not having strong design, but part of that is because it's a loose design that's designed to expand and contract with different languages. But I definitely endorse the per language CSS. That's a really clever idea.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Hi, I work at a casual game site called Pogo.com, and we now have sites in French and German, UK English, and US English. And our biggest challenge now is every time we release a new feature, we have to localize it. And often the biggest issue for us is actually legal stuff. So we have like a prize system where we give away, you know, cash prizes and gift prizes in different countries. And the legal rules for every single country or so. So we have our localization isn't just by language, it's by country as well. I was wondering if you could talk about how to deal with legal issues. You know, for example, what we often face is that we'll have to talk to several different legal representatives in different countries, and even finding out what the actual laws are in the different countries is very difficult, and what the requirements for the project are. So sometimes that's a big time sink for us. Thanks.
Thank you.
I can probably take this one. And honestly, you're right. There's no easy way around it. So at iStock, that's one thing that we actually have different people translate the legal documents than translate everything else on the site. So that's kind of the first part. And you're right. Contests are a nightmare, especially like someone from Quebec sitting beside me. Even within Canada, you'll always see valid anywhere in, you know, the US or Canada except Quebec. Just because it's so different and it's such a pain, you know, to deal with, that what we mostly do is actually put on contests that are localized. So it's just become far easier for us to do it that way than try to make a contest that works worldwide. It is a bit of a nightmare, and you're right, and I don't think there's an easy way around it.
Okay. This will be our last question.
Quick follow-up on that one. One organization that has taken an interesting approach on that is Creative Commons, where they've done the work to translate the licenses into the different legal systems. So they have some experience there, and that may be a place to start. But it is a problem. The language is not country thing. Is people need to get their heads around, because they start out with easy ones like Japanese, which is mostly one country. But as soon as you get into Spanish or French or other languages, the people are dispersed, and they will be in place with different rule sets.
Okay, so our last question, and after that, I'll let each panelist give us a closing word, or, you know, you get a little bit of free mic time, and then we'll end because we've got 5 minutes until 11. Okay?
So it strikes me that there's been a lot of talk about translation of interfaces and translation of text, which, you know, if you're thinking purely about copy, is fine. But what happens when, you know, you have to look at different locales and languages where, you know, the sort of paths to cognizance are different? different. So, for example, Korean applications tend to be understood better if they're more tightly packed, for example. Japanese, they like, you know, very, very long form pages in contrast to sparse interfaces in the UK. How do you deal with that sort of thing rather than just the simple, I have a button with a piece of text on kind of things?
Well, what you...
Did you want that?
I'll start and you can have a go. This is something that we face a lot at Google, and it comes down to having people from that language, from that culture, to review it and make sure that they're there. This is something we said earlier in the back channel. It can be dangerous to outsource the whole thing to a translation company and then not check it. So if what you should do is recruit users from the countries and locales that you're translating to and make sure that they are in the beta program and QA stuff and feedback that loop for you. And make sure... There are subtle cultural things. If you look at Google Maps, when you go to different countries, the maps look different because they look like the map for that country. So the British maps have green roads and the French maps have red roads and the Japanese maps have a different set of roads again. So that's a subtle thing, but if you look at it in the Europe thing, you can see that there. There's a problem there. Is if you're an American driving in England, you get confused by those maps because you expect the roads to look different. That's something that's hard to solve, and it's not straightforward. It's not a straightforward process, and we have to iterate on it.
Okay. We probably won't have much time for free speech afterwards, so we can,
I would just add that you need to think carefully about how many what resources you really have to work with. So if you're a large company, obviously you'll probably be thinking in terms of, addressing as many markets as you can. If you're a small company or small project, you should probably really think about, what are the top two or three languages we should start with and focus on those. And then I think in certain languages, you end up with such a different user interface because it's a right-to-left language or something like that, where you should probably also think about having a different product or maybe even a different brand. It just depends on what you're selling. I guess my point is sometimes you can get into the trap of trying to localize your product too much and you end up with something that's kind of okay in a lot of languages and not really good in a few languages.
Okay. Anybody else want to add something or say a final word or give a final piece of advice?
Well, I would just say quickly that we did run into those exact problems. We ended up hiring people in Japan that were experts in the industry already just to help us out with issues like that, because there was even little things like in Japan, a lot of people expect a phone call as soon as they've registered on a site, which is over here would be so, almost offensive.
So for full disclosure, I actually work for Yahoo in Europe doing lots of international stuff. And we actually had a similar experience to that where there was a particular piece of copy in one of the Japanese sites where I think it was translated slightly wrong or put slightly wrong. And we actually had to, I think I had to have a video broadcast across Japan of the CEO in Japan sort of apologizing to everyone.
Okay. I'm afraid I'm going to have to stop the discussion here because otherwise we're going to run over. I hope that you got something out of this panel, that you've left with ideas or at least questions or thought processes. If you want to come and quiz the panelists and pick their brains, you're welcome to come and stop by. And unless anyone has got another closing word to say, this is going to be it. Thank you very much. Have a nice day.